All right, Proverbs 11. 11:30. Let's talk through this one a little bit on the heels of, not heels, on the toes, I guess, of heading into Ruth. This one reminds me of a gentleman that we will meet today. 11:30. Okay, the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, right? What does that mean? Who's the righteous in Proverbs? What does that mean? Unpack that for me. 11:30. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. Who are the righteous? Good, thank you. I'm starting off with easy answers, so... Thank you for showing up today. Those that are God-fearing, right? And what should be one of the qualities of a God-fearing person? What should they do? What should they be? What does it mean to be a tree of life? Blessing, right? It's a gift to those around them, right? They're a blessing to be around. People should want to be around righteous people, okay? Great question to ask yourself. Do people like you? Do people want to be in your presence? Do they enjoy being around you? Are you a tree of life to them, okay? A true God-fearing individual should have that quality. Other people should say, you know what, I like being in her presence. I like being around him. They're pleasant, okay? They are others-centered. They're not thinking about their own problems and needs and whatever is going on in their life all the time. They have those things like the rest of us, but they're focused on what's going on around me and how can I provide, right? Brad has said it a number of times that a tree's fruit is not for the tree, right? It bears fruit not for itself. It can't use that fruit. Apple tree dispenses apples but doesn't use them. That fruit that they bear is for others, right? Same way with our life, right? The righteous person bears fruit that doesn't benefit themselves. It benefits those around them, right? They're other-centered in their focus, okay? And what does it mean, the backside of that? He who is wise wins souls. What does that mean? And then what?
No idea.
That's good. Now, you're thinking through this through a very New Testament lens, which is fine, because that's appropriate, right? Christians should be leading people to Christ and having good, passionate conversations with people. This is Old Testament, okay? We're not talking about the gospel here, okay? What does it mean for a righteous person to win souls if we're not talking about evangelism? What does that mean? Yeah, you're attractive to people. You're winsome would be the personality trait that we're talking about, right? I like that person. I want to be in their presence. I see their actions. I look at them. I watch them. Man, they're pleasant to be around. I had a friend of mine in seminary that was that guy. He was just pleasant all the time, right? His life was not pleasant all the time, right? It wasn't perfect. He didn't walk on rose-petaled paths and levitate and like everything was perfect and he never felt pain. He felt it more than a lot of us. But this guy was just fun to be around, right? He asked questions about me every time I was in his presence. Mike, how are you? What's going on? How's Michelle? How are your kids? What's going on with this, right? It was hard to talk about him in a conversation because he so wanted to talk about me. Mike, man, what? Fred, I love you. Great guy, right? I remember getting in a, we were in chapel every day at church, at DTS, at seminary. We had to go to chapel, right? It was right? Sometimes they were great. Sometimes it was like, really? Like I go to church 9 times a week and just everyone's like, just done. And we're sitting in the front row and we got in one of those totally inappropriate giggle fest deals where you start laughing and I'm laughing at you're laughing and now you're laughing at the fact that I'm laughing at you're laughing and you can't stop. And it was probably 30 minutes and there's a guy on stage speaking and talking in Hebrew or whatever, and we are just absolutely cracking up. And it's like at a funeral when you're laughing, you're like, this is so inappropriate, but you can't physically stop. And you know, bouncing in your seat, trying to contain yourself, and then you glance over and you think he stopped and he hadn't stopped. You're like, oh God. So, but man, I have great memories of this guy just because he was so other-centered, right? Ask yourself that about you. Do people desire to be around you for those type of qualities? Do they just want to be in your presence? Because 30 seconds, 5 minutes, 5 hours with you, they left better than they came, because you're just that type of person. You win souls, right? That is a great quality to have about you, okay? So if it's not, okay, work on it, okay? If you're not a likable person, you're no fun to be around, okay? I was just listening to a story this morning of, that was pretty obvious, wasn't it? Sorry, I'm a master of the office. That's why I read Proverbs and not Psalms, because Psalms are very spiritual and hard to interpret. So, Proverbs for stupid people like me. Like, okay, that's what I need to do. These are more for me than you. You guys are just listening to my quiet time, so this is what God tells me. So if they're not helpful for you, it's because you're smart and spiritual. Me, every year, got to go through these. What was I talking about? Seminary. Stop screwing with me, people. Making me... Our pastor was talking about going to seminary, and they have a placement guy at seminary, right, whose job is to take all the graduates and connect them with the church. And he said he went into his office, our pastor did one day, and there's a stack of resumes. And he's like, what are those? And he said, well, those are DTS grads that we can't place in ministry anywhere, right, that are qualified, THMs, have more knowledge and understanding of the Bible than, you know, me and everyone else combined, right, just brilliant guys. And he said, well, there's not a shortage of need in churches right now for good pastors. I know that that's not the case. He said, no, these are just people that are continued failures in ministry. He's like, what do you mean they're failures? He said, they can't get along with people. Like, no one likes them. So I can't put them in a church. Doesn't matter how educated they are. They're smart and they did great and they got all A's in seminary. Good for you. But they can't get along with people. No one wants to be around them. So we can't put them in a church. They're useless. So you know what happens to those guys? Honestly, it's gross. They go back because they can't do anything else, and they go get a PhD. Okay? And they go hide in the library. And then they figure out, okay, I'll get my PhD. And then they try to go minister somewhere. You know what? You think anything's changed? No, they're just smarter people that no one wants to be around. So what do they do next? Where do they go? They become teachers at the seminary. And it's this big pool of, like, a lot of the professors that are, I shouldn't say a lot. I had great professors. There's a portion of professors out there that couldn't make it in the real world of actually talking with humans and being likable, so they end up in a classroom, right? And I love the classroom. This is one of my favorite environments ever. There's nothing wrong with it. But if that's all you have because you can't be likable and sympathetic and deal with people and be a servant and, like, boy, it just doesn't work, right? So be careful, okay? If that's not a quality that you possess, you should, okay? It's not super hard to be about. It's just about being others-focused, and that will take you a long way in life. Okay, so there you are, my friends. Thoughts on that? We're going to watch a guy this morning that is unflippin' believable at this. Okay, you're going to meet Boaz. If you have not before, Boaz is a stud. And he is the quintessential others-centered, what's going on, how can I help, what can I do to be a blessing to those around me. And he lives every day when he gets up with that question. How can I be a blessing to those around me? Okay, God's blessed me, how can I bless others? Okay. Powerful. Ruth, such a good book. I used to not teach this in residency. I don't know why. I think I was too intimidated by the awesomeness of it and scared and screwed up. So it is a love story. Girls, you're going to like this. There are a lot of feelings in this book, right? Which is very awkward for me. I don't really know what to do with any of those. So I'll have to ask for interpretation of what those things mean as we get there. There are certain portions of scripture that I feel a greater sense not to screw up. Not that I can screw up others and feel okay about that. But some of these stories are just so, they're so well written. They're so powerful that you want to take the time to paint it right. So hopefully we can do that together. We'll see. This is a great book. So if you've never been through Ruth, we're going to go through it in fifth gear. So we'll try to pause a little bit, but this is a pretty powerful book. So with that, let me pray, and then we will dive in. God, as we are just in the midst of this journey, as we're now in March and a little laboriousness of getting up at Odark 30 and the difficulty of ministry and life and jobs and school and just all the things that we are involved in are upon us. Would you give us the strength to finish well, to keep our heads above water, to be men and women that continue to seek your face, to try to model our lives after you? God, would you encourage us from a book this morning where we get to see unlikely heroes and people that you're going to use in amazing ways, stories of individuals who lived real lives of difficulty and pain and suffering and triumph and victory and everything in between. God, would you teach us from Ruth, from Naomi, from Elimelech, from Boaz, from these characters that are so real in our lives. God, would you use this time this morning to continue to shape us, teach us about you as we see, God, just the facets of a diamond as we look upon you at different angles and get to see different just glimpses of who you are that will only become full realities when we get to sit in your presence and worship you forever. So God, teach us this morning, we pray. In Christ's most glorious name, amen. All right, so let's look at Ruth, all right? If you saw the chart that The Well did on Ruth, you guys remember the theme that Brad chatted about as he walked through this? I don't even know how much time we spent on this, as I recall. It was really quick. What's that?
It was very short.
Mm-hmm. I think it was about that long, actually. Ruth, moving on. Judges. So there's two themes. They brought up the one of redemption, okay, which I think is a great one. So you're going to see an amazing redemption story in here by the hand of a great redeemer. The other one that I think is pretty powerful as well is the providence of God, okay? So I think they're both good to kind of think through. This book is about God's sovereign hand of movement, but it's not God's visible, apparent, like miraculous parting of the Red Sea, parting of the Jordan, let's go into the land and let's go beat down a bunch of like Shaquille O'Neals with, you know, some farmers that are right with their Calphalon pans. Not that sovereign God, okay? Same sovereign God, I should say. Not that sovereign, clear, miracle, wow, look at you, God, okay? This is the very normal, mundane, everyday, God's up there working everything. And it's kind of a bad picture because we're not robots, but he's the marionette maker, and he's got the strings, and he is orchestrating situations exactly how he wants them, okay? And that's really important to see because, as you know, all in this book is not good, right? There are things that are, in chapter one, we're going to see some really rough circumstances. But God is sovereign behind the scenes, working situations to how he wants them. And he's going to take people he loves through tremendous difficulty, through tremendous hardship, and he is going to redeem those people through the process and bring about a greater good in their lives that wouldn't have taken place had he not allowed them to go through pain and suffering and difficulty for extended seasons of time, okay? So redemption, okay, and the providence of God. That is the two big pictures of Ruth, okay? So four chapters, okay? One of the best, again, written historical portions of our Old Testament. And we're just going to dive into it, okay? We'll start talking about it as we go, all right? So our hope is to get through all of this today if we can, all right? Chapter 1, verse 1, Ruth.
In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons.
You can just see how quickly these stories unfold, right? There's so much just in verse 1 of all that's happened. Okay, so what time period are we in according to verse 1? Judges. What does that mean? What's going on in the nation? Yeah, we're in the middle of this season. We don't know exactly where. More than likely, it's probably between about 1200 and 1000 BC, so this 200-year span. Okay, so we're in the book of Judges. Tell me about Judges. Just remind me. What's the spiritual temperature of the land right now? Yeah, very low, right? And what did we see was the pattern in Judges? Right in their own eyes, and what did that result in? You guys remember the cycle, right? Keep the cycle in the back of your head. Israel's obedient, they worship God, they begin to talk to people from other nations, they become enslaved to those people and their gods. God says, you know what, I'm fine, hands off the steering wheel, I'll let you do whatever you want. If you want to go pursue other gods and wrong marriages and immorality, go for it. The people get enslaved to those gods and they finally cry out, and then God does what? brings a judge, okay, rights the ship. People walk with God, abandon your idols. They right the ship. They do great things. They get back to worshiping God, and then what? It starts all over, and it's like, okay, so we are on the hamster wheel, okay? That's where we're at, so keep that in your mind, okay? So we find out during the days of the judges, there was a famine in the land, okay? Why would there be a famine in the land? Again, book of Judges, why is there a famine in the land? What is God doing? Punishing them, okay? We're going to find out this famine is localized, okay? Famine is in Bethlehem. Okay, you guys remember Bethlehem, right? Right just north of Jerusalem. We're in that area. And where do they go? Where do these people go to find food? East, to Moab. How close is Moab? Not that far, right? We're not talking about a worldwide famine. This is like, right, just over the Jordan River to the east. They went south of the Dead Sea to go over to Moab, and there's food in Moab, okay? So this is a localized famine, more than likely as a result of these guys being spiritual knotheads, not walking with God, and God says, fantastic. I'm gonna put your hands on the chalkboard, and I'm going to use difficult circumstances to discipline you because I love you, and I'm going to bring you back to me, okay? So famine in the land, okay? And what do we find out? Certain man from Bethlehem. By the way, Ruth is full of great meanings behind words. What does Bethlehem mean? You guys have studied this in your learning. House of bread. There's a famine where? In the house of bread. Okay, so fascinating that these people would have been from the house of bread. Jesus obviously is going to come from there and say that I am the bread of life, right? So there's a famine in the house of bread in Judah. So a certain man, okay, we're going to find out who this guy is, went from Judah to Moab with his wife and his two sons. So he leaves town to go find provision. So he leaves God's home to find what would fulfill his physical needs, okay? Do we ever see God tell them to leave? No. Do we see this guy ever pray and ask God, Lord, is this what you want me to do? This feels a little bit like Abraham back in the day. I just got land. God promised me land, seed, and blessing, and here I am. Oh, doo-doo, there's a famine. What do? I should run to Egypt, right? And that's what he does. And you just see kind of a ready, fire, aim mentality. That's this guy, okay? Let's find out who he is, verse 2. Elimelech. There you go.
And the name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion.
Mahlon and Chilion, okay? Mahlon and Chilion, okay? And they are from Bethlehem. They are Ephrathites, how you ever say that, right? They're from Ephraim, okay? So there's a better way to say it. It's like the Merarites and the Gershonites, and you're like, man, that's like a Ferrari, but Merari, and I can never say it when you add the ites on the end of it, okay? You'll need to know those names later. Okay, so what's this guy's name? Verse 2, who's dad? Elimelech. What does Elimelech mean? Anybody know? Eli Lamech. It means my God is king. Sounds like a great name, right? So here is my God is king living in the house of bread. He leaves the land of God to go find food in a foreign land of Moab, okay? Not a good decision. So, fascinating. Tell me about Eli Lamech's parents. Why would, the cycle of sin and judges, why would parents name their kid, my God is king? Yeah, so tell me about his parents. Godly, right? My God is king, not other gods, not Moab, not Chemosh, whatever, right? My God is king. What type of guy is Elimelech? Apparently not very godly, right? He's a lot like a Samson, right? I got great parents, and just because I come from a great heritage doesn't necessarily mean that my kids are going to be great, right? So here's this guy that doesn't pray. He leaves. He takes his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, out of Bethlehem, and then they go to Moab, and they remain there, okay? So, by the way, Naomi, what does Naomi mean, ladies? Anybody know? Not yet. We're getting there. Hold on to that one. Her name means pleasant, okay? Pleasant, okay? It's a good name, all right? Naomi. Two sons mean sick and dying, okay? That's what Mahlon means, sick and dying, okay? Chilion means puny or pining, okay? So not great names, right? I've got like you know, 104 degree fever, vomiting. Okay, that's one son, right? And about, you know, and then this guy who's like 6'2" and a 105, right? And looks like, you know, he just got skin on top of his bones. Those are his two kids. So probably born during a time when this famine was in the land and Israel was disobedient. Okay, so those are his two kids. Okay, so they entered into the land of Moab and they remained there. Okay, now why would Elimelech leave? Guys, think through a dude's perspective. Why did he go? Right. So what's he trying to do? He's trying to provide for his family. He's trying to be a good dad, right? Okay. You're dying, I'm dying, there's no food. You know, but they probably sat in that for a long time and realized nothing's changing. So what do? You know, he tries to do the right thing. He leaves town, goes into a land that clearly has food or he wouldn't have went there, right? And he's trying to save his family, okay? So good intentions? Absolutely, right? You can't fault the guy for at least trying to save his family, okay? Now, verse 3. So what was he trying to do? Save his family. And what happens as soon as he gets to Moab and he stayed there for a while? He dies. Great. Okay, so the very thing that he was trying not to accomplish, like he could have stayed in the land and that would have happened, right? So he leaves the land trying to find life and he finds death, okay? And now you got Naomi, whose husband's gone, okay, which means provider, worker, guy that's going to go out in the field, right? She's now left with no man, right? She was left with her two sons, okay? Verse 4, as a result of this, what happens?
They took Moabite wives.
Read that for me.
These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth.
Okay, and they lived there about 10 years, okay? So as a dad, how do you hear that? Is that what you would have wanted for your two sons, to take Moabite women as wives? Obviously not, right? That wasn't, even for a guy that doesn't appear to be all that spiritual, he knows better. So what is he feeling now? What's happening as a result of him walking outside of the will of God, apparently? Consequences to sin, right? You're dead, okay? And your sons are, where are they going to get wives? Well, where are they around? They're around a bunch of Moabite women that are worshiping Chemosh. So that's what I know. So great. That's my pool to fish from. Okay, so bad move as a dad. He's trying to provide for his family. He puts his family in a very difficult spot. And this is the result of that, right? So dad's just something to think through, right? You know, if that's the pool that your kids are fishing from, then something to think about, right? Are they being exposed to the right type of women or girls, to the right type of guys that are around so that they can potentially marry godly husbands? That would be good, okay? So they end up with two Moabite women. One is Orpah and the other is Ruth, okay? Orpah comes from the word that means obstinate or stubborn, literally the back of the neck, okay? So what type of woman do you think she was? Not a Naomi, not pleasant, right?
Do they name these women like after they're
known, like from birth, they're known that they're not pleasant? Yeah, it's like, right? We're going to call you B.O., and we're going to call you stiff neck, we're going to call you difficult to get along, right? It's like, man! So, and again, names have a lot of meaning, and it's significant in this book that those are how they are, okay? What does Ruth mean? Friendship, companion, or special friend, friendship, okay? So a lot better than, you know, Dripping Faucet, which is her sister's name, or now sister-in-law, Orpah, right? So, okay? So they marry. They're there 10 years, okay? Verse 5, keep going. Uh-oh. So what happens? Both. Now you've got dad dead and the two sons are dead. So all the male providers in the family are gone. What else? Keep reading.
So that the woman was left without the two sons and her husband.
Okay. So we've got now father dead. Okay. Two sons dead. What else do you notice in 10 years of marriage is not present? There's no kids. Where are the kids? Been married 10 years, right? Why are there no kids? We're in the book of Judges. Why are there no kids? What is God doing? I've shut down the womb because you're in sin, and I'm not going to bless that, okay? So you get the picture that this was not a great act of obedience and prayer on Elimelech's part. He's trying to be, you know, he's just trying to provide, right? And he takes a step out of the will of God. God wanted him, apparently, to stay in the land and to do what? What would have been the key to them getting back on the right track? Repent, worship me, stop worshiping your false gods. So he said, no, I'm going to go to Moab where there's food. I'm going to take the easy way. And as a result, God is cranking up the difficulty meter in their lives. So dad dies, son dies. After the sons have married and been there 10 years, they die with zero kids. So now you've got a mother-in-law with two kids that are from Moab that she just inherited with no father. She has no husband to provide for him. She's in a bad spot, right? This is not what you would hope for as a mother-in-law, okay? So pretty yucky situation, right? Okay? So let's peel back the onion real quick and just let's talk about what's going on from a 30,000-foot view, okay? What is God doing, big picture? What are you seeing? Have we even seen God's name mentioned yet? I don't think we have, right? Is God's hand clearly on this situation? Yeah, I mean, knowing the book of Judges and knowing what we've been through, he's clearly apparent and he's there, okay? And God is working through the midst of circumstance. So, okay? So let's talk a little bit, once again, about sovereignty in God, okay? In big picture, okay? Hence the blue marker, okay? There are kind of two ways that you can look at the situation. When we talk about the sovereign hand of God and his providence in life, there are two things that must be dealt with if you're going to have a right view of God's, really of sovereign election and a sovereign God, okay? You need to deal with this issue of sovereignty, and B, you need to deal with this issue of God's intent or his goodness or lack thereof, okay? Those are the two primary things as we talk about sovereignty. If you say that God is sovereign, okay, he's able and he's in charge, but he's not good, what happens? What is the end of that theology? God is able, but his heart is not for his people. The end result of that is a very cruel God, right? It's I'm in control, but my intent is not what's best for you. I don't really care about you, okay? So I'm going to let life unfold in a way, okay? Tragedy's going to come, difficulty's going to come, and it's going to come because I don't care about you at the heart of things, okay? Mark Driscoll calls this cruel Calvinism. And I think it's a great description of what that means. It's not when someone talks about being a Calvinist and having a high view of God and his sovereignty, this is not what that means, okay? Sovereign, but not good. Or in our words, we could say he can, but he won't. He is able, but he's not going to act because he doesn't care, okay? When you see tsunamis, rape, difficulty in life, what is the number one question that people outside of our camp ask of us? How can a loving God allow things like this to happen? What are they assuming? You say your God is able, okay, but he allows these things to take place because he clearly doesn't love you. So one of two things is in play. Either he doesn't really love you, okay, which is what we're talking about here. He's not really good. He's sovereign. Or he's sovereign, or not sovereign, but he's good. He really, really wants to. He really loves you, but it's out of control. All these circumstances in life are completely out of his control, okay? So the one side is this kind of cruel Calvinism of, boy, I can, but I won't. The flip side of that is what we call open theology, or being an open theist, which is I am good, but not sovereign. I love you, but I am unable to act, okay? Both of those are wrong views of the sovereignty of God, okay? Open theism, by the way, was the number one hot topic button when I went through seminary, you know, in 1642, okay? That was the big debate on campus. And theological-minded people that spent way too much time in libraries would say, God basically loves us, okay? He got the world spinning, right? Kind of like a deist, and then put it the globe on and kind of let whatever happened would happen. And he's like, I hope this all works out. I love those people, but, you know, bad people and bad circumstances and floods and all these things that happen, I just really can't control, OK? Okay? That was their take. Okay? And it leads to really, really bad theology because you've got a really puny vending machine God at the end of the day that really can't do anything, but he's got a really sweet heart, right? Nobody wants that God. Okay? A proper view of God says he is able, he is sovereign, he is in charge, nothing happens outside of his sovereign hand, and he is good. And if that's the case, maybe when bad things happen, his definition of good is different than our definition of good, and maybe his definition of good is better. And difficulty and pain are actually good for certain things, and he allows difficulty to intercede in our lives because he cares about us and loves us, okay? Now, that is a hard reality to face when you look up and your husband's dead, your two sons are dead, you're in Moab, you still don't have food, you've got no grandkids, and you're like, God, what the heck? What did I do to you, right? Where's Naomi left in all this? Dude, she's dealing with the shrapnel of a dumb, ungodly husband's decision to move their family to Moab. And now she has to take on the beating of that, right? Was this her fault? No. And you're going to watch Naomi point a very interesting finger in the midst of this as to where she places the blame. Fascinating, okay? So keep that in mind, all right? Tuesday, I lost a friend of mine in a bike accident, okay? Tuesday morning, there's a ride that we go on. I've been riding that ride for probably 5 years. Meets at Copper in Auberry, and we ride out with 4 guys or 40 guys, depending on what season it is, and we ride out that road. Okay, any of you that have ridden up Aubrey Road to Sherry's Roadhouse have seen cyclists out there. It's the most popular cycling road in Fresno. And this particular morning, there was 14 guys that went out, and one of my buddies was at the back of that line. He was getting ready to turn around, and he turned apparently into an oncoming car from behind him and didn't see him. And he got hit by the car and was knocked unconscious and died pretty much at the scene. He's a 55-year-old guy. He has 3 kids and a wife. He loves Jesus. He's a great dude. And in the midst of all this, everyone that has been a part of this is now sitting in the shrapnel just saying, what's happened? I visited this guy in the hospital 6 years ago when he wrecked on the same road, hit a pothole, and ended up in the hospital for weeks because of a bike injury. And you think, gosh, of all guys that this should happen to, it's probably not Jim Healy because he's A, he's super godly, B, he's already been through the ringer. God surely wouldn't allow something like this to happen again. And sure enough, here they are. So difficulty. And that family has one of two responses. They can either say, God is good and he's sovereign and he's allowed this to occur, or they can say, he clearly doesn't love us or he's not sovereign. He doesn't care enough about Jim to protect him from that situation, or he wanted to, he just couldn't. And he's not sovereign over that Jeep and the timing and Jim not hearing the car or seeing the car and Jim turn in front of him and now there's a tragedy. So those are the responses that you're left with. And Naomi's going to have to wrestle with this in her life. You guys have had to wrestle with similar issues in your life, okay? Maybe it's not the death of someone that you care about. Maybe it's circumstantial. Maybe it's smaller things. Maybe they're bigger things. But your theology is going to get pushed in this area. And you're going to have to choose who God is in those moments. And I'm watching a family right now that's trying to put the pieces back together and still cling to a right view of God in the midst of really difficult, painful tragedy that has no good explanation, right? Try sitting in a room with a wife that's just lost her husband, with 3 kids from 13 to 17 that have just lost their dad, and try to tell them that God is good and God loves them and God cares and God's in control. Why did that happen, Mike? I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Okay, so, but this is life, okay? This is what happens, and in the midst of it, we have to cling to it, okay? And I think what's fascinating to me is Naomi's the one that usually gets the really bad rap in this book. She probably has some of the best theology of all the people in the book, okay? And we'll see how she chooses to respond to this, all right? So there's our situation. Crappy, but here we are, okay? So in 5 verses, we are in a really, really difficult season, okay, for these people, all right? You see why this book is so good, by the way? It's like, holy cow, right? This is phenomenal, okay? Difficult, but this is reality, okay? Verse 6, here we go. So what has God done? Yeah, why? Book of Judges, why?
They repented
They repented. Okay? So she hears from Moab that God has visited his people, giving them food. So they repent, and God says, okay, I love you. I've loved you the whole time, but I put you through difficulty to get you to this point. They repent, and now God turns. First time his name is mentioned in the book. Okay? God is in control, even in this difficult situation, and he gives them food. Okay? So what's their idea? Go home. Let's go home. God has provided in that land. I've been here 10 years. I'm done being here. Let's go home. Keep going.
So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each of you to your mother's house, and the Lord give you kindness to you, and you have brought the good and the meat.
So what is her instruction to Orpah and Ruth? Go home. What does that mean? Where is she telling them to go?
Moab.
Stay in Moab. And go back to your dad. Go back to your mom. Go live in your family's house. God has been, God has opened up a door for me to go home. May God be kind to you. May God be hesed to you. And that's what we're going to do. Okay. May God, verse 9, grant that each of you find rest in the house of your husband. She kissed them. They lifted up their voices and they wept. This is the final parting. Okay, Ruth and Orpah are going to go home to Moab where they belong, and Naomi's going to go back to her homeland where she belongs. Okay, and this is their response in verse 10. Okay, so they say, "No, we're going
to
go with you." Okay, and we're going to see how sincere that really is. Verse 11. Okay, stop right there for a second, okay? What was the job if your brother was married, okay? He died. What were you obligated to do with your brother's wife? Marry her. Be a kinsman redeemer, right? Redeem her so that she didn't lose her inheritance and her field and that sort of thing, right? So that was the job. So Naomi's saying, do I have other sons? No. Do I have anyone to marry you guys? No. If I got pregnant today, are you going to wait 15, 18, 20 years for these kids to grow up so that they can marry now 50-year-old women? I got nothing for you. I've got nothing. So go home, okay? Good luck in Moab. Your odds are a lot better staying here, okay? So it's difficult, okay? Now, here's some really good, really hard theology from the mouth of Naomi. Finish up verse 13. I thought this was Elimelech's doing. Who does she point the finger at? Not herself. The hand of the Lord has gone out against me. How does she view these circumstances? It's God's doing, right? Does that sound, unpack that for me. How do you hear that? She certainly feels like that, right? God's hand is against me at this time, okay? Keep going. No, I'm sorry. Keep going. Talk to me about it. But that was good. Squirrel, what just happened? sorry. Usually keep going means read more. You're right. So you have to be in my head. Right? So she says, God's hand's against me. How do you guys feel about that? Is God in control?
It's a difficult verse. She's saying, I mean, it's exceedingly bitter for her, so she's probably angry, she's frustrated, she's, in a sense, probably crying out to God a little bit, just saying, like, what the heck?
Tell me about her theology. Who's in control in Naomi's worldview? God. You like that? Okay. Is this God's doing? Yeah. Absolutely. Now, is he angry at her and trying to punish her? It feels that way in her life, right? God's hand has gone out against me, meaning he has aligned circumstances in such a way that I'm here, okay? I get, this is a temptation for me not to respond this way. And I actually have a great respect for Naomi being that gut level honest, and yet even in the midst of pain, not blaming people. I have a tendency, and I don't know how you guys operate, when things don't go my way and there are humans involved in decisions that don't favor me, where do you think I point the finger? Them. It's their fault. They should have done, their sin, their hard-heartedness, their lack of perspective, their not understanding me and what, it's their fault, right? How short-sighted is that? If God's really sovereign, do you think he can use, even if that is the case, difficulty, hard-heartedness, pain, to bring Mike's life into such a place where he wants it? Yeah. And it takes a lot more spirituality to go, God, boy, I don't like how that unrolled, and I don't like where that left me, and I'm not wanting to be here, but you're still in charge. One of the things I love about my wife is that she always, always has that perspective. She doesn't like it. She doesn't necessarily enjoy it, but she is always able to bring me back to out of the me focusing on me and whining about my circumstances to say, if God's sovereign, we're here for a reason. This isn't by accident. We know he still loves us, but he's bringing us through difficulty for whatever reason. So suck it up, quit whining, you know, go B&M to somebody else and deal. This is where we're at, right? And she says it a lot nicer than that because she's a girl and she has feelings, so, which I don't understand. But she's able to raise my perspective often, right? And that usually takes a lot more time for me because I'm not as godly as she is. But that's where we're at, okay? I like Naomi's response. Gut level honest, God's hand is against me. Now, that doesn't mean that God is punishing her or he's cruel, but he's setting up situations in her life that are difficult. And she says, yeah, that's what it feels like. And there's times in my life that I felt God's wind at my back and it felt easy. Right now, man, it's a headwind and I'm fighting it and I don't like it, right? So God's hand is against me, right? One of the Puritans named John Flavel, okay? His name is not important. He called this process sanctified affliction. Like God is bringing you through difficulty to teach you something. I think if you guys are honest, as you look back at the seasons of your life, you have probably learned more in difficulty than you ever have in times of great prosperity or great times of everything's great, white picket fence, 2.5 kids, can make the mortgage, PG&Es, everything's fine. We tend not to learn a lot during times of success. This is God's incubator for this is where you grow. This is the Petri dish. And sometimes it ain't fun, right? But God still loves you. He is still sovereign. And if you have the character and the perspective to be able to cling to that belief, then kudos to you. That is hard to say, God is sovereign and he is good, even though my circumstances don't look like it. Okay? So, okay? You with me? So I like Naomi. She whines a little. Okay? So I'm going to give her some credit. But she's got a right view on God, I think. All right? So, and don't take that verse out of context and to mean something that I don't think it's meant to mean, okay? I don't think God is against her, like he is bad or evil or whatever. He's just allowing her to go through difficulty, and he's going to use that to bring about great good, okay? So she says, basically, I got nothing for you. Go home, okay? 14, keep going. Why did Orpah leave? Hey, I love you, Naomi. I'm going to go with you. There are no benefits to going with me. Go home. What does Orpah say? See ya. I'm going home. No husband, no inheritance, no food. Ooh, that's a dumb choice, right? She leaves, okay? No benefits of walking with Naomi down that path. What does Ruth say? But she clung to Naomi, okay? Why did Ruth cling? For all the benefits? There are none, okay? She has, she says something here that only two other Gentiles say in the entire Old Testament, okay? Keep going in 15. Let's see her response.
And she said, "Here, sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister."
But yeah, and what else is Orpah trusting in? Her gods, right? I'll go back to Chemosh because your god... We've been here 10 years, ain't done nothing other than make us hungrier and, you know, our life worse, right? So thanks a lot. I'll go back. Ruth, however, does not. Keep going in 16. Ooh, so what does she say? I like your God. Really? The God of famine? The God of difficulty? The God that killed my husband? The God that allowed us to be hungry for 10 years? The God that shut down my womb and I don't have kids? I want to go follow that God? Why does she want to follow that God? Okay, potentially. Who has she seen worship that God? Naomi. Who is the winsome person? It's Naomi, right? She's the one that has demonstrated faith in the midst of this. Honest faith, at times borderline like, whew, yeah, I don't know what to do with Naomi's responses sometimes, but she's watched Naomi's faith not get shattered in the midst of this. And she's coming home, gang. This is an embarrassing deal. She's coming back to Bethlehem with her tail between her legs. She went out risking and failed miserably, and now she's coming home. This is not a triumphant entry back into the land. This is a... you failed, right? And she's coming home with nothing, okay? Someone had a question. Absolutely. You know, I agree. I think her faith's going to grow. I see this as a conversion right here. I think this point in Ruth's life is where she says, there's a fork in the road. I have to make a choice to go back to Chemosh and Moab and worship those gods or follow the God of Naomi. And with no benefits to following Naomi's God, she says, I'm in. I'm going with you. Having no idea what the road ahead holds. Okay, and we're going to find out, by the way, food in the land doesn't mean, great, I get back home and there's a feast waiting for me at my table, right? It's not that simple. They're going on welfare. In a very different welfare system than we have here, okay? So I see this as Ruth just said, I want to be a follower of their God, okay? We saw this with Rahab, okay? And we're going to see it with a guy by the name of Naaman in 2 Kings. Aside from those three people, you don't see this type of conversion all through your Old Testament. So think about that. The number of Gentiles that come to Yahweh in the Old Testament that make that type of statement, 3 in all that time, okay? So... for the most part, that at least makes statements like that, all right? And she keeps going. Look at 17. This is a pretty significant speech.
Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. For the Lord is so to me, and
so she just put all her poker chips in the center of the table and says, I'm in, okay? There's no turning back. I'm burning the ships. There is no plan B, okay? When she saw that she was determined to go, she said, no. She said no more to her. Okay, so she says, you're in. Great. Okay, so 19, let's keep going.
So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman said, is this Naomi? She said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me.
All right, so what does Mara mean? This, Teresa, this is the run, okay? Bitter, angry, ticked at God, okay? So she's lived a hard, difficult life. I am not pleasant right now. I don't feel pleasant. I feel my life is painful. It sucks, and she's calling it what it is, right? So that's the hard part, right? So she's, is she this great, winsome person and happy to be around right now? Probably not, right? She is having a rough go, and she's trying to keep it together and maintain her theology, but she's like, man, life's horrible, right? I'm hungry. My husband died. I've been living in Moab watching these knotheads worship Chemosh. My two kids died. I got no grandkids. What do I have to live for? It's awful, right? That's Naomi. And you look at her and go, girl, I feel for you, right? It is a hard day. And absolutely. So you went from pleasant and sweet to bitter because the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Once again, where does she point the finger? God's in control, okay? My husband made a dumb decision. We should have never come here, but God is still sovereign in the midst of my difficulty, okay? Keep going, 21.
I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?
Now, how did she leave? She says she went out full, but has come back empty. How did she leave? Was she full physically? No, she was hungry, okay? What does that mean then? What is she speaking to? Yeah, at least she had a husband and sons, right? So full is probably referring to her family. Like, I went out with, you know, my man and at least two kids, right? And now I'm coming back with Ruth, the Moabitess, right? That everyone's like, who the heck is she, right? You brought some foreigner into our land that worships Chemosh? All right, we're trying to repent right now. So, and again, you see it again. The Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me, okay? She is bitter, but she's honest, right? And I like that about Naomi, okay? And I think that is, man, that's some of those heartfelt Psalm David confessions of, God, when are you going to vindicate my enemies? My life is hard, and I feel like you're just on me, right? Your thumb is on me, and I can't get out of this season for whatever reason, all right? And by the way, we don't see sin in Naomi. She didn't cause this, right? This isn't a self-inflicted gunshot wound. This isn't her stupid that caused this. It's just life, right? So there she is, okay? 22, let's finish up chapter 1.
So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest.
Okay, so good. It took us an hour to finish chapter 1. Lovely, okay? Came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So what are you seeing the first signs of? Chapter, end of verse, chapter 1. Food, right? There's food in Bethlehem at the harvest. Okay, that would have been late spring, like right now, probably April, or towards the beginning of summer. So we're in a season of growth, of newness. We left in winter. It was dead. Now we're seeing life. Okay, so let's see what happens. Let's watch the sovereign hand of God. Chapter 2.
Now Naomi had a relative of her husband, the worthy man of the clan of Elimelech. His name was Boaz.
Okay. Boaz, what does that mean? Anybody got a note? It means strong, strength, okay? That is Boaz, and that is, he is a man that is physically strong. He's also going to be a guy that's character is strong. He is going to represent that word well, okay? So we find out there's a dude in Elimelech's family somewhere down the food chain, okay, that is a relative, okay? And he is introduced as this guy with strength of character, strength of being, okay? Keep going in two. All right, so she says, please let me go to this field and glean, or go to the field and glean. So what is she asking Naomi permission to do? Work, right? Let me go to work, right? Naomi, you're old, okay? You're a widow. She, based on what she said, is past childbearing years, right? So she's old. Ruth is still young. She can work. So she says, let me go to work, okay? So they just came into the land with all this food. How are they going to eat? They got to go work for their food, right? There's no handouts. There is no freebies. There's nothing that's just waiting for them. So they didn't go into Israel thinking, oh, everything's going to be fine and great. There's food. It's like, no, we got to go work for it now, okay? She says, let me go glean in the field among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor, okay? So specifically, what is she asking to do based on our Levitical laws? What does it mean to go glean in a field? The leftovers, okay? Remember the field, square, you harvest it in a circle, and you leave the corners. The corners were for the poor, the people that didn't have any, the widows and the single moms, right? Or at least the single that couldn't provide. So she says, let me go find a corner of a field, and maybe I will find favor in somebody's sight, and they will allow me to come glean in their field. Maybe somebody out there is generous enough to leave me some, you know, that's going to take part in the welfare system, okay? And what does Naomi say in verse 2? Great, go for it, okay? Verse 3, keep going.
So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come up to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech.
Okay, has she ever met Boaz? Does she know who Boaz is? Does she know that he's a part of this family? She knows nothing about this guy, okay? I want you to underline in verse 3, she happened to come. What does that mean? She just happens to show up in some random field and starts harvesting grain for a guy that just happens to be generous, that just happens to love God, that just happens to want to bless others. What's going on here? God is being sovereign in the midst of the situation. There is no such thing as she just happened to come and blah, 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 blah. God brought her there, right? Boaz is introduced in verse 1 of chapter 2. She doesn't know where she's going. She says, hey, I need to go reap in the field. So she leaves and she's like, which field should I go to? That one. And she does. Okay, so she begins to travel in that field. Okay, and she shows up and starts gleaning. Okay, so that's how that goes down. So she is in the place where God wants her. All right. So happens to come to the field that was Boaz, and he happens to be from the family of Elimelech. Okay, let's watch this story unfold. Verse 4.
Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you.
So what do you immediately see about his character? What type of guy is this? He's godly, right? His employees like him. He's a good boss, right? He's godly. You see these things. So immediately, right off the bat. Okay, keep going.
Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this?
So he's out inspecting his field, right, as a manager, as an owner, and he's like, who's this gal in our field? I've never seen her. No idea who she is. Guys, you've been here all day. Who is this? Okay? Whose young woman is this? Keep going.
The servant in charge of the reapers replied, she is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. And she has been sitting in the house for a little while now.
All right, so let's unpack this. Okay, so Boaz says, who is this gal? And the servant's answer, verse 6, is she's the young woman. She's a Moabite. So immediately right off the bat, she's a foreigner. She's a Moabite. Boaz is a godly dude, so he knows Moab and all that would have come with that. Okay, she's returned with Naomi, who he probably would have known from the land of Moab. Okay, and his servant says a little bit more about her. What do you notice that he communicates in verse 7 in terms of who this gal is? She's a hard worker. Girls, tell me something about what Boaz immediately sees in her. What is he attracted to? Because we know he's going to be attracted to her later. She's a hard-working woman, right? How long has she been in the field? From morning until now, when you find out it's evening, okay? She's been working all day in the sun, and she's been sitting in the house for a little while, meaning she's taken a break, but she hasn't taken a lot. She sat down to rest, but she's been working all day, okay? He elevates immediately her character, okay? Sees that she's a hardworking woman, and that is what Boaz immediately sees in front of him, okay? So we know that kind of where this story ends up. Okay, here comes the feeling portion, so guys, be careful. It's going to get muddy. So he's immediately, we know, attracted to her. He sees her character, right? Notices her, wants to know who she is. By the way, age difference between Boaz and Ruth? A lot, okay? Boaz isn't going into the situation with like, right? There's not false motives here. He sees himself as, he's the older single guy. For whatever reason, he's not married, but he does not see her as a potential. It doesn't seem that way, at least. This is not someone that he's trying to lasso in. He's just trying to be gracious and kind to her, right? So verse 8, okay, but there are still some good nuggets in here that I think we can take away. Neither one of them have met each other, okay? And what happens in verse 8? Stephen, read that.
Then Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maid.
Okay, so who starts this conversation? Boaz. Why is that important?
He initiates,
right? How about that? He's not passive. He's not sitting on his hands. He's not waiting for the girl to ask him out, right? He initiates. Hey, I'm going to do something, okay? He takes charge in a godly way. He takes charge and says, hey, Ruth, don't leave my field. Continue to stay here, okay? You're welcome in my field. In fact, don't go to another field either, okay? Stay here with me and be with one of my maids, okay? Stay here with the rest of the workers and the other gals that are here, okay? Verse 9, keep going.
Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw.
Man, so what else does Boaz say? Protecting your... I've commanded my servants not to touch you, okay? They're going to take care of you. If you're thirsty, you snap your fingers and water's coming. You're taken care of. Stay here. This is a safe place. Now, verse 2, what did Ruth pray? I'm sorry. Yeah, 2-2. Keep going. Go in the field, green grain, glean grain. Find favor. Maybe someone will take notice of me. What just happened? Her prayer just got answered, right? And she freaks out. She's like, whoa, this is weird. Verse 10, this is her response.
Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?
So she asked the obvious question. You were being exceedingly generous to me. Do you have false motives? What? Why? I'm a Moabite, right? Do you know who I am? So she's immediately a little like, what's going on here? Okay. Why have I found favor in your sight? What are your motives, dude? Right? That's kind of what she's asking, right? And Boaz says in verse 11, he calms her. Read that.
Boaz replied to her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know.
Okay, so he's like, hey, I know your story. You've had a rough life. I've heard about you. I've heard about Naomi. It's been hard. And I care about your situation, right? Who the heck is Boaz? Did he even care about that, right? He's a businessman. He's got apparently plenty of wealth. We're going to find out later that he's got his junk together, right? He's not some single guy playing Xbox in his mom's basement, right? He's a leader. He's strong. He's managing fields. He's probably got a ton of fields, which is why he's visiting this one. And he's probably been to others during that day during harvest. And he's got workers. And he takes notice of some random girl in his field and says, who's that? Tell me more about her. Why is she here? What's her story? So what we got here in 6 and 7, he probably even got a longer version of, it's Naomi, and here's her deal, and Elimelech, and Mahlon, and Chilion, and Puny, and dying, and weak, and saw Sissy. They died, right? He got the director's cut. And he says, I know your story. I've inquired. What has he been doing? Tell me about this gal. Tell me about her. Tell me who she, like, he's getting information, right? Is that okay, guys? Absolutely, right? Is roommates, tell me about her, right? Is she pleasant to be around? You know, what? Tell me your backstory. Is she godly? Is she, tell me about who she is, right? So he gets information, okay? Verse 12, keep going.
May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge.
Okay, so Boaz prays a prayer here. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, okay? So he says, I hope that your work is great. I hope God rewards it. And God of Israel, who's under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. So who does he kind of give credit to for all of this? Not kinda, God, right? Now, it's fascinating. Who's going to be the answer to that prayer? Ruth, may your work be great. May your wages be full. May God bless you. Who's going to answer that prayer? Not just God, but who specifically? Boaz. Boaz prays a prayer and then he says, oh, I'm the answer to that prayer. Isn't that weird? So does Boaz sit around waiting for, God, I hope you bless her? No, I have the means to bless. So he's going to, and we're going to see him hook her up, okay? So God's taking care of you. You're back in a good place. You're underneath the shadow, literally, of God's wings. He's protecting you. And then she says to him in verse 13, keep reading that. All right, so you're seeing the initial, like, first interaction between these two. We find out there's an attraction, a mutual attraction from both of them, okay? And they're working through this process, okay? So he's provided for her. He said, I'm going to bless you. You're safe. This is a good place for you to be, okay? So at mealtime, verse 14, let's watch what happens. Right, so he shows up at evening. She's been working all day. She's hungry, and he says, "Come and have a meal with me."
So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and have some left.
What did he do? He served her. I mean, this is the big man on campus. He's in charge of everything and anything and everything that's going on, and he serves her, right? Well, she sits with his reapers. So they're all taking a break. And everyone, no, they're not alone. Yeah, no, they're not alone. They're eating together. They're taking a break. And he invites her to come and eat with them, right? So it's scandalous is coming in chapter 3. We'll have to deal with that, okay? So lest you think it's not coming, it's coming. But this is good. And he serves her, right? He makes it a point to not let his workers serve her, he serves her. Okay, again. And then it says at the end of it, he had some or she had some left. What's Boaz thinking? He serves her, she's full and satisfied, and she has some remaining. Boaz knows her story. Takes them to Naomi, right? Guys, take care of mom, right? You go take care of the mother-in-law. He's making sure he cares about it. You see his intentions? This isn't just about Ruth. This is about, I'm a blessing. So she's at home. She's hungry. You've come out here to work. Take this home with you and go feed your mother-in-law, okay? Keep going in 15.
When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves and do not reproach her."
Ooh, something just changed. What happened in 15? Stephanie, what just changed? Where does she get to glean now? In the circle. So no longer is she in the welfare system outside. He says, come in here amongst my reapers and glean in the sheaves and do not insult her. Like, not a word from any of you guys. I've invited her in and she gets to reap with you guys. Also, keep going to 16.
And also pull out some from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean and do not rebuke her.
What does that mean? What are the bundles? This is the harvested wheat, okay? Song of Solomon. There's a funny verse we get asking Ronan about this when we were in Israel. They would take the wheat stalks, okay, these big long deals, and they would tie them in the middle, right? And there were these big things. And he's saying, this wheat that you have harvested, take some of it out, right, and leave it for her. So it's like, do some of the work for her. She still has to do some work. She still has to winnow it. She has to free it from the wheat and the chaff. She still has to kind of go through that process. So it's not, it's not a handout, but he's making it a little bit easier for her, okay? Solomon compares his wife to a heap of wheat, okay? It's an really odd response. And Brad, I remember because he taught Song of Solomon somewhere on the bus and he was asking Ronan, like, what does that mean, okay? If you took a big thing of wheat, okay, like 6-8 feet tall, and you tied it in the middle, what does it look like? And that's what Solomon calls his wife. Like, oh, got it, okay. So, right, so you're a heap of wheat. And Ronan was like, moving on. So, okay. So I was like, got it, my man. So anyway, so they've harvested this wheat. They've done the hard work. They've cut it down. They've tied it together. And they said, take some of it out and just leave it for her. Don't insult her. Okay? Let her have it. Okay? So what is she seeing from Boaz? Well, this is exceeding generosity, right? Like, amazing. Okay? He has gone above and beyond, right? Not just, hey, you can hang out in my field, which would have been like, okay, that's a really generous guy that left the corners of his field as it is. He invites her in. He is serving her, makes her dinner, takes it to her, comes and says, hey, and I invite you into the middle of my field. She gets to glean among the sheaves. It's impressive, okay? So she's probably a little stunned and overwhelmed at this point, right? And that's what she prayed when she left. God, I need to find favor in someone's sight. So here we go, okay? 16, keep going. 17.
So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out where she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah.
Okay, so again, she has to work for it. She has to, you have to beat the wheat out and the chaff rises and blows in the wind and you take the good stuff home. And how much does she end up with? This is an ephah of barley. Anybody got a note on that?
Three fifths of a bushel.
Okay? In a, which means nothing to me because I'm not a farmer. Like, what's a bushel? That's 30 to 50 pounds. Okay? That's about 2 weeks worth of work that she got in a day. Monetary equivalent, $2,000. For a gal that's on welfare that left this morning with nothing, she's going home with $2,000 worth of grain. Holy cow, right? Boaz wasn't screwing around. He's like, look, I'm going to bless you, okay? What is Boaz trying to communicate? I like you. I like you, right? I'm going to take care of you. And why would he send her home with tangible goods? Why is that important? Show the mother-in-law, like, this guy's not messing around. Like, this is legit. It's not just this, like, I think he likes me story. Are you still hungry? Yeah. Like, no, he fed me. He's feeding you. And here's all the work that I did today. And boy, I can't work that hard. This was a blessing, right? So Naomi's able to see, holy cow, this guy, he is not messing around, okay? So she comes home with a lot of money, okay, in the sense of what that would have been valued at, okay? 18, read that. Right, so that's what Boaz sent her home with. Here's food, take it home and, you know, the Tupperware, feed it to your mother-in-law. Make sure she's full. Okay, keep going.
And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today and where have you worked?
So she's like, what the heck? Like, where have you been? This is amazing. Where have you been today? Okay, keep going.
Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz.
So 19, what does Naomi ask? My wife made this observation. I thought it was fascinating. Where? Where? Where did you go? Where did you work? What does Ruth answer? Does she answer the where? No, she answers the who. Like, it's not about where. It's about who. God brought me in front of this man. And it was because it had nothing to do with location. It had everything to do with God bringing her. It just so happened that she came into the field of Boaz. You're like, man, God, right? He brings her there, okay? So amazing. So Boaz was the answer to the question, okay? 20, keep going.
And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead.
Okay, now stop there. Talk to me about Naomi. Fascinating commentary. What does she say? May he be blessed, okay? May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness. What did Naomi say in great difficulty in her life? Who's responsible? God. When there is now exceeding blessing in her life, who's responsible? Not Boaz, God. That is great theology, right? The temptation would have been to say, oh, Boaz, you are my functional savior. Thank you, okay? You have made this all change. God stinks. He's abandoned me. His hand has been upon me for difficulty and affliction. What is she able to see in the midst of it? I give God glory on the mountaintop, and I give glory to God in the valley. And everywhere in between, he is sovereign. Phenomenal theology. Okay, I like Naomi, right? Bitter, honest, but she gives glory to where it's due, and she points at the right person. Okay, that impresses me. Okay, she understands that Boaz is a part of that. Without his godliness and without his obedience, that wouldn't have happened. So she says, may God bless him. But God's in control, right? So here's a woman who's been through the ringer. If anybody we can learn good theology from, she's been there, right? This isn't some gal that's only walked on, you know, water her whole life and everything's been handed to her with a silver spoon. She says, no, God's still in control. In difficulty and pain and in triumph and victory, God is still in control. So great response from Naomi, okay? And it's a lot easier to have that kind of response once you've eaten too, okay? So blood sugar's up, and she says good things. At least it is for me, all right? So blessed be this guy Boaz, who has shown kindness to the living and to the dead, okay? Keep going in verse 20.
Naomi also said to her, man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers.
Okay, so Naomi knows more about Boaz than Ruth knows about Boaz. She's been hanging out with this random dude. She doesn't know who he is. Some old guy, probably with, you know, like the little bald on top or whatever. Just like, he was just some older, single, super generous guy that took care of me today. And Naomi says, oh no, he's one of our relatives. In fact, he's one of our closest relatives, okay? She knows this guy is in Elimelech's family tree. He fits in there somewhere. So this is news to Ruth. The man is our relative. That's one word. And then one of our closest relatives. Okay, anybody know what that word for closest relative is? Kinsman redeemer. Okay, it's the word goel, G-O-E-L in Hebrew. Okay, and we'll paint that picture a little bit more in a bit, but I want you guys just to hear it. Okay, she says to, Naomi says to Ruth, this guy is a relative of ours. In fact, not just any random relative. He is a guy who is able to redeem us from the situation. Okay, you guys remember Leviticus and all the stuff that we talked about with the brother and, you know, taking upon the wife. Okay, he is in a position to do that. He's one of two guys, apparently in the story, that can fulfill this role from Elimelech's family. Okay, so she's like, okay, you know, whatever. 21.
And Ruth the Moabite said, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close to by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.
Okay, so he said, hey, come back tomorrow, okay, and glean some more. How long was harvest, by the way? 6-7 weeks, okay, probably in this day and age. So he says, hey, you've got a backstage pass for a month and a half, 2 months. You come every day. Okay, and every day you're going to go home with blessing. So he says, great, come on. Okay, so for 6-7 weeks, he gets to go every day into her field and harvest, and it's a good time, all right? So that's what he has asked of her and said, you've got permission to do that. Okay, 22.
And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted.
Right, that's the danger in the harvest, right? That's when you guys heard of foreign armies coming in and destroying crops or whatever. Like, this can be a dangerous situation. You've got different people in the fields, okay? So she says, it's obviously, that's good for you. Like, thanks, Naomi. Yeah, we know that, right? We're there. But she says, do that. Stay with him, right? That's a good situation for you to be in, okay? Keep going in 23. Okay, so day one with this couple, what happens? What do we see in this relationship? Just paint the picture for me. What's Boaz doing? Boaz is asking questions. He's initiating.
Getting to know one another.
He serves her dinner and talks about it. Now, what happens from that point on for the next 6 to 7 weeks? We don't know. There's not a lot of information. So she's showing up at work every day. Sorry, Evan. No, wrong answer. No, maybe, okay? The text is silent, okay? So maybe she's showing up to work every day and she's out gleaning in the field. Where's Boaz? Man, he's got a bunch of other fields to check on. He's probably checking on her, but we don't see this like every day, come and have lunch with me and I will dip grapes into your mouth. Like, we're not seeing this develop, right? So where's Ruth at right now? Ladies, where's Ruth at? She's working. Emotionally, where is she at?
She likes him, but he's...
Yeah. I like you, and what are you doing, dude? What are your intentions? You came on fast and furious, and, you know, I'm like, okay. She's attracted to him. Boaz has no clue. Like, he's, again, why is he not pursuing her? He hadn't even thought about it. He's just trying to be generous. And Ruth's like, no, there's something else there. So, like, this attraction kind of, in a way, starts on her side. She is very attracted to his what? His character. This is not some smoking hot dude, right? This is not Saul. This is not Samson. He was not a looker, right? He's not the guy that walked in the room and everyone went, oh, dude, check it out. He's here, right? He's not that guy. He's an older guy, he's respected, but he is not a guy that stands out amongst other men in terms of his physical appearance. But Ruth is very much attracted to him. And she's probably dying to know, dude, what's going on? Like, we started, I'm attracted to you, and I've been here working in your field for 6 to 7 weeks, and boy, you've been incredibly generous, and I am protected, and I'm going home with stuff every day, I get to feed my mother-in-law, life's great, but what's happening on the, like, me and you scene, dude? And the answer we get is nothing. So what does Ruth do? Gals, talk to me about this situation. Y'all all have been there, or you will be. Y'all, that's a whole new one. Y'all, Let's go with that.
The text says it's that she's staying close to the women. So probably kind of sticking with them, just waiting.
Yeah.
Straight up like that miserable wait.
Sitting and waiting, right? And that's a good place to be sometimes. As hard, because you don't have answers. You're trying not to initiate and maybe not try to do too much, but still kind of make your appearance know, like, oh, hello, you know, like, I'm still here waiting, right? Do something, Boaz. But she waits and she's patient, okay? And she allows the guy the freedom to lead, which is important. Sonny, have we had some of that situation? Uh-oh. Please
share.
Can you get that for me? Oh, thank you, Boaz. Nice. Very good. I like that. Today I'll remember your name. only for today. All right. So you kind of get the situation that, okay, they've been doing this for 6 to 7 weeks, and then what? Okay. Well, the then what is chapter 3. Okay. So harvest is over. They've enjoyed the bounty and this relationship. What's going to happen now? Yeah, I can't just show up at his house every day like I have been and working in his field. Like, that natural, like, life group's about to be over. You know, WSM and, you know, us ministering together, it's about to be summer. Like, what do I do, right? Like, she's stuck in that situation trying to figure out, what do I do now, right? And Naomi steps in, okay? 3:1.
Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz a relative with whose young woman you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash therefore and anoint yourself and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking."
All right, so who's giving her advice at this point? Naomi. Now, ladies, who do you want this advice from? Think about it in your life. Who do you want right now to be giving you dating and engagement, marital relationship advice? Specifically. How about dad? How about the godly man in your family? Ideally, right? You would want a godly dad that's around that you've said, "Wow, dad, you've got a good marriage. You love mom. You've done this right." That's in an ideal situation. That's what you want, right? Your dad saying to, "I love you. I care about you. I've got a God-honoring marriage. Honey, this is what you need to do," right? Now, it's an imperfect, broken world. Very few of us have, like, godly parents to look to and that sort of thing. Most of us don't, if we're honest, right? That's the lot in life. So she's got the next best thing, right? It's not ideal, but guys, this is why marriages are so important, right? This is the role that you guys are going to play one day for your kids. They're going to look to you and go, that's my example of a marriage. And if it's crappy, then that's marriage, right? I don't want to be married, or I'm going to do it my own way, because whatever you guys are doing ain't working. So you guys have God and Jesus and a Bible and church, and yet, boy, on Monday night, it's Jack. I don't want any part of that, okay? When you have a God-honoring marriage, that's a good place to be. So she doesn't have that. She's got, you know, a pagan dad back in Moab that probably isn't a real good example, and she's got what she's got. So she gets advice from Naomi, okay? Verse 3, what is Naomi's advice to her? Interpret that for me, Emily. Get go get Purdy, right, with a U, okay? How has she been looking this whole time? Like a farmer, right? Like, does she get up and put on makeup in the morning before she goes to work and out there in her high heels? No, she's grungy and dirty. And by the way, in this day and age, how is it viewed to be tan?
It's not
a good thing. It's not attractive. Why? Because you're a servant, you're outside working. So if you're pasty white, you're good. You get to stay inside. You're an inside girl, okay? She's an outside girl. She's been working. So just like when Solomon pursued his bride, she says to him, "I am swarthy. Like, I've been outside working in the field with my brothers, right? I'm sunburnt, right?" In our day and age, everyone goes and gets fake and baked, and that's a good thing, right? Apparently, that's what they want. That's what our generation wants. You go to foreign countries, they walk outside like the really rich people. They walk outside with umbrellas in the Oriental countries because pasty white is good, okay? Not here. So this is a different culture. So she is dark. She's been sweaty and nasty, right? According to her, at least. And that's how she looks. So Naomi says, take a bath, put on some deodorant, you know, shave your pits and go out and look nice, right? Wash your hair, okay? So, Nish, did you have a question? Someone over there. No? Jeremy? We're going to see the cloak from Boaz in a second. I think it was just some nicer clothes. She is gonna disguise herself in a way. So
she's giving good advice on like eating and drinking too. Like wait till he's finished eating and drinking. Like wait till he's happy.
What does that mean? Okay, it's harvest. Yeah, wait till he's had 2 glasses of wine, maybe 3, but not 4. Right? Okay. So he's full. What is harvest? Like, what's the picture going on in this moment?
Feast.
It's a feast. It's a party. Like, our crop has come in. There's bounty from God. Guess what? We're not going to starve. Huge party, okay? Oh, boo. Okay, we will finish tomorrow, all right? So, no! Okay. I know it. Nope. No, we'll get into the scandalous tomorrow. So it will be good. All right. So we will pick up on the rest of the story and we will watch how this unfolds tomorrow.
It's like the OC.
Yeah. The OC. Scandalous.